Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is part two of my conversation with the executive coach and Dare to Lead facilitator, Elena Armijo, who we did part one last week, and she said something at the end of the podcast, and it hit me so hard that I immediately said to her, Elena, we need to continue to talk about this. So here we are. We're going to continue to talk about this. So Elena, it's a welcome back because we're not recording this back to back, but for the people listening, if they listen, this is like, oh, it's like we went to the commercial break, but no, we're actually recording this, I think, 3 weeks apart.
We are.
Because of schedules, but I'm so glad to have you back here to talk about the thing. And let me share with the audience what you said, and then we'll do anything that you want to share before we really kick off. And I have a feeling this is going to be a pretty in-depth and deep conversation with some things that are not talked about as often as they should be. And I'm pointing the finger at myself here. So what Elena said at the end of that episode, she said, we're not aware, we being, I think, society, businesses, people are not aware of the impact that not being inclusive has for us as a society, for us in the workplace, all the different places that you and I do our work. And I was like, and it's like, you saw me. I was like, oh, I don't know the impact. Because I'm a straight white man in my 40s over here living in a, quite frankly, I live in a New York state, which is, for my political leanings, is very nice, right? So it's like I didn't know that. So I really felt like convicted to talk more about this, one, selfishly, because I want to learn from you. And I figured if I'm going to learn from you, why not have a bunch of other people listening learn from you as well? So that's a genesis of this conversation. So Elena, again, welcome back. For those of you who are listening back to back, it's going to feel like a commercial break.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me back. And thanks for wanting to have the conversation.
Yeah. So why don't we start by maybe defining a few things?
Sure.
I think for those listening, let's start with the term inclusivity. Mm-hmm. This gets thrown around so much.
Yes.
And again, I think that we're just going to have a conversation. I'm going to share some of my opinions here as well. It gets thrown around rather flippantly in the business world, the American business world, I think, from certain companies. You hear them talk about it, and then you look at the statistics and you go, well, how do you claim to be inclusive when your board or your C-suite or your hiring practices? So how, when we talk about inclusivity, how do you define that?
I define inclusivity as meaning that you are making space at the table for a lot of different things, diversity of thought. So the way that I want to start this conversation as well on my side is that diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, DEIB as we know it, is highly politicized in the U.S. right now. I wouldn't say the whole world, but definitely in the U.S. So one of the things that I've done in my personal work is to get out of the context of politics in DEIB and back into the root of the words. And that's really what we're also looking at in the C-Suite Collective. So when I think of inclusion or inclusivity, I'm thinking of diversity of thought at the table and that all are welcome. That's really how we're framing the conversation up.
Yeah. So you mentioned something about politics. My stance on this is it is politicized on both sides of the aisle. So it's a bipartisan thing. It's not this party hates it, this party likes it. It gets used as a weapon on both sides, to be very clear.
Correct.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And therefore, it makes it really hard to talk about right now because of the way the words have been, you know, used in different contexts. And I don't want to say hijacked, but that's a bit what it feels like, is that all of those words now have become so politicized and tied towards agendas that we've lost the root of what we're actually trying to create in cultures.
Mm-hmm. Business leaders listening, I would say most people care about this to some degree. They actually do. Yeah. Most individuals do care about this. So what do you see that gets lost as it gets into more organizational or the politics or societal? What gets lost around inclusivity and DEIB that takes it from let's agree, most people care, not all, but most people care. And then it either gets lost or it's just feels like it's just for show.
Well, It's interesting that you said what gets lost, because to me, it's something that we've maybe never grounded in. So, when we say that we've never lost something, I don't know that we've ever had it, you know, to begin with. And look, I agree with you. I think most people, a generous assumption of most people is that they're doing the best they can. And I really do believe that about all humans. And so if they're doing the best they can, where have we not tied inclusion and belonging to business? And that's really what I'm looking at, because look, this is a great heart-based conversation. And I hope that, you know, we go there when you ask why it directly impacts you. You know, that's where I was looking, from a couple of places around a spiritual side of the conversation and also a metric side of the conversation. But when I'm talking to organizations about this, of course, people want to care about humans. And if we cannot tie an ROI to it, it doesn't make sense for the health of a business. And those are the things that I think have been missing in the DEIB movement, is we haven't created enough data or connected enough dots for people to see the results of the business from a different place. And because of that, what we've seen organizations do is they get worried about it and then they try to fulfill a quota or check a box. We've seen that happen many times over the past, you know, 50 years. What does that look like where they say, okay, we're addressing this issue from this lens, but it's always been from a lens of should instead of anything that's based in metrics, which I think is really powerful when we come from data. Yeah. What we're seeing in cultures that have gotten away from diversity of thought is they become very exclusionary, and a lot of things that are toxic start to enter the culture, like shame. You know, I love Brené Brown's work for this reason, because shame is rampant in organizations. And if we were approaching this from a courageous place or a daring place, which are her words, but from my place, a place of belonging, then this would create something completely different. And I'm excited about the possibility of ROI from that place, because imagine what could be created. And so that's where we typically start the conversation with people.
Yeah. So if we're looking at, you mentioned the spiritual and heart-based part of this, I want to take it back to you. To you here, and then I'll share my kind of like why I care as well. But why do you care so much? I'm really interested in why Elena cares.
Well, I care personally because as a biracial woman, I've been in the middle my whole life. Right. Yeah. So my parents are of different race and ethnicity. My mom is, you know, French, German, Irish, white, and my dad is Latin, right? Or from Spain, actually, so Hispanic. And the two of them together navigating their relationship and their cultures has been something I was born into. And they are even different politically. You know, one is liberal, or more liberal, I would say, and one is more conservative. And even being in a household of politics, having to navigate those messy middle conversations was fascinating to me. And what I've learned in the world, being a biracial woman, especially when I don't really feel like I belong in either place, is that you have to learn to create belonging inside yourself first, so that you can then be able to hear and be in any room with any person. And so a lot of my work has excavated the gold that's in the mess. And for me, there's so much value in being in the mess with people, as opposed to having the right answer, having it handled, or having one right way to get this all right. That has never yielded as good of results as just letting things be everything all at once.
Elena, you said something really powerful there. You've had to look internally first.
Yeah.
Which is, from out here, is not the general message for especially for companies. It's bringing it, teach us stuff so that we can learn things, so that we can learn how to do this. But this is the first time that I've heard somebody say around this topic, I've had to go internally first to work through that. So a couple things. First thing is, love if you would share with us, you know, in the theme of impact, what was some of the impact for you being a biracial woman in your career? And we talked a little bit about this on part one of this as an opera singer, a little bit of that impact. And then when you say I had to do the work, what does that mean for somebody who doesn't know what that means? Because that's that is something you can own and control.
Yeah.
But you can't control that a-hole boss or that company who doesn't care. So I'd love to hear those. Love to hear both of those things. I'm so curious about both of these.
The impact on me we did share this a little bit in the previous podcast, but what the direct impact was is I had to figure out who I was going to be at any given moment in any given room. So, you know, the opera industry way back when, when I first started it in 2007 professionally, was pretty far behind in terms of diversity of thought and belonging. And it's an older art form. You know, we're singing music that was written in the early 1700s or 1800s. And so there's a lot of tradition that comes along with that music that we really wanted to revere and honor, and from a place of grace, have it be something that we pay attention to. So our roots in the industry, or the roots of musicians or composers. And there wasn't a lot of space for newness. And the way that we saw that directly impact that industry at the time was that we were losing donors and we were losing audiences. And music that once was very relevant, because, you know, opera, when it was created way back then, was politics. People wrote to say something in the world where they typically didn't have voices to speak up or couldn't because of a kingdom or rulings or politics. And so we lost some of that on the way towards bringing it to America. And I would say only in the last 10 years or so have we really started to see it revive with new composers and new writing that are being welcomed to the scene. It doesn't mean that wasn't happening before. There was always composers writing new music, but they weren't necessarily welcomed. And so my personal experience has been one of being, there was a lot of instances where I was controlled, or I can remember specific instances, like, if you don't sing a phrase this exact way, then you will be fired. And it was the exact way, based in tradition, that they thought it should be, instead of any artistry or any room for me to show up at the table. So that's just one example of many over, you know, 20 years, where I had to really navigate a line of power dynamics and hierarchy and decide where were my values and where was my line, which I really think is the conversation for everyone in these organizations, because we are working to change systems. If we're speaking specifically about race, you know, which is where you and I started the conversation last time, systems of white supremacy, then in those conversations, it's taking time. We know that. We've been around for that conversation for a really long time. So in the middle of that, who will you be? Who will you transform into as a person in light of the system that's in front of you now? And that's really the conversation when I say that we are going to start with you first, you know, looking at that. And when I say I've done the work, you know, it's really great. Thanks for calling it forward, because I say that offhand. And as a coach, we say that probably 100 times every day and nobody knows what that means. And what it means is I hired a coach, and I hired a coach to look at all of my blind spots in the world and really unpack where I'd created my career from. And when we started uncovering some of those stones or some of those places that I had never looked, I found out a lot of things. I found out that I was proving my worth in the world constantly, which is not necessarily about race or ethnicity, but what it is about belonging, you know?
Yeah.
And we can track that from a therapeutic standpoint, right? All the way back to whatever event or trauma happened in your life. And so there was that piece, but then I also had to be with all the ways that I had survived in the world with it, like masking, which is or code switching, you know, which is a very powerful conversation for most people that are POCs or people that are marginalized. And on one hand, I had to really unpack what the cost of masking was for me in my soul, and then I also had to look at what a superpower it was. Right? There's two sides of the coin. That I could walk in a room and actually be able to code switch and mask, which it would not only was a survival skill, but it was now in my profession, a skill that allows me to talk to anybody in any room. Right. Yeah. So it was all confusing. And really what I had to do was get real about what I believe, what my values are, what my sense of integrity is, and then from there, choose who I was going to be in the face of some of these places that I either wanted to create or choose belonging. I'm not going to say create belonging, but choose belonging for myself or not.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the mindset of I belong here. regardless of the external. But it's, I guess, like I hear that as a, like a self-esteem, not a self, maybe a self-esteem, but like a value, like valuing yourself enough and knowing about your value independent of the identity part of it that yeah. has you belong. There's something I want to share, and I was just sharing with you. I was at a retreat recently, and there was, it was a men's retreat. There was a man of color there, and we were talking about some of the things that we learned how to do. And he was sharing how he learned to walk into any room he's ever walked into and immediately scan for all the danger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Real or not, because he was a man of color. And I was just blown. That goes back to the, and like part of the reason we're here is the impact of like, I'm a white guy. I grew up in the suburbs of St. Paul. I never naturally walk into a room and scan for danger. I'm like, wow, that's so interesting to think about. What immediately came up for me, what came up for me, and when you're talking about your code switching and adapting, is how exhausting that must be to have to do that all the time. When you're like in that mode of learning to operate that way in the world, that must be tiring.
It is. And what I'll say is, you know, the thing I want to own is I have a lot of privilege, right? Like I have a lot mm-hmm. of privilege. I come from middle class. I am white passing. I can walk into a room and people aren't even sure what I am, which is mm-hmm. holds privilege too. So I want to say that I certainly don't have it as exhausting as other people might. And what I notice is that even that has been confusing, right?
Yeah.
Like being in the middle and being like, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that I should actually look at how exhausting it is for me? Or does that mean, wait a minute, I need to work on my privilege side and I need to look at that? And that, you know, when we're in conversations about where you do the work, what I've landed in, because frankly, there's actually not a lot of research out there for biracial people right now. Like there,
really?
The conversation is not nuanced enough yet because we are still in conversations about reparations, you know, for people of this country. And so I think it's going to be a long time before we even get to a conversation around what is the work the biracial people need to do. And so in the meantime, I'm doing all the work, right? I'm looking at my white side and everything that I need to look at, own, heal there, my privilege. And I'm also looking at my Latin side of what I need to own or what's been lost or what I want to reclaim. Right. And so that work is many layers deep. But I think the most important thing, you know, in the C-Suite Collective, we talk about a three-phase approach with organizations. And the first step is getting real. And that's actually like what we're doing right now. We're getting really real about what's on the table or what you know versus what I know versus like what's the soup we're swimming in right now. And then the second stage is belonging to self. And that's where we spend a lot of time with organizations, again, going back into what are the places that you've forgotten about? What are the places that are costing you something? What are the places that could be exponentially created in a different mindset that would produce not necessarily more, but different, because more would be part of the same system, right? So those are the conversations we're in. And I'm so appreciative of you wanting to have this conversation at the next level, because what I said at the end of the podcast was even you in a system of white supremacy may not be aware of what it's costing you, right?
Yeah.
And
right.
And oppressors or people at the top of a paradigm that are winning or having power dynamics are also losing, but it doesn't look like that. And you don't experience it like that because there is so much privilege and so many things that are winning above others.
Yeah.
But when you slow it down, you can really find what it's costing you.
I'd like to go into that here in a minute, getting present to what was coming up for me around that too. Yeah, I want to get into that. But Elena, I'm just feeling called to see if you have any questions for me so far. I don't know. I want to put that out there.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, how have you experienced inclusivity and belonging in your life?
Yeah. I've experienced a lack of it for sure in how I was, not how I was raised. My parents are amazing, but I grew up in about as white bread as you can. I grew up in a suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota, and I graduated at a big high school with 550 kids, and we had one black kid who came in our senior year. So I had no real experience. None of my friends were of color. And then I went to a college that was, it's big, but I, you know, you naturally group with the demographics. And I'm glad you asked me this, because then I moved to New York City in 2005. And I'm like, wait, there's a lot of different types of people. And these are great people.
Yeah.
And realize the inclusivity of like it in New York. I started to work with folks of like BIPOC and started to become friends with them. And the inclusivity is like, I didn't really even, I hate the term, I don't see it. Cause I think that's just to say you don't see somebody's color is like, this is my own opinion. Just being really real. It's kind of bullshit, because that would mean that you're actually not paying attention to them. Right. But not only that, but you're actually like, but also like you're then not acknowledging their actual identity. Like it'd be like, I don't see color. I may not see what it means about you, but I am going to see color. But like just getting to know folks that way, and then starting to really, my wife and I, and my wife works at a very inclusive company, historically very modern tech company, where she started sharing her experiences with me. Would she had some folks that were transitioning or were non-binary, a lot of different like racial profiles, and just talking about like, it doesn't really matter. And I never thought it mattered, but then I realized I came in with, like most people do, with my own thing, because it's only my experience from my childhood and then earlier in my 20s. And how I've experienced it now, I think coming to now is, you know, the work that I've done as a coach and the trainings that I've done is, and I've coached a lot of folks that are not like me, sex, race, gender or sexual orientation. And just coming to realize, I'm just speaking my truth, is we're all the same. It doesn't really matter. Like it matters and it doesn't. Like it matter, your identity matters greatly, but we all want the same stuff. And when you like when I can relate to people that way, and I would assert that might be truth for organizations too, in many ways. And what gets in the way is all the normal human crap that gets in the way of most everything.
Yeah, well, I love that you said human crap, because that's actually, those are the things that I think keep the systems in play, right? And you're right. I think everybody does enjoy diversity of thought and expansion and who they are. And that's really what I heard in your share. So thanks for sharing it, is that you got to experience other people in unique ways and therefore see, well, what did that do to you?
It definitely expanded my like purview, is what I would call it, or my, it's like, you never know till you walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. I've been fortunate to have some pretty deep conversations with people not like me, but even just observing, and again, just going back to my childhood, is when you're raised in such a homogenous way, I think I just assumed everybody was like us. And like, which is, I think, like, again, the psychology that is, I think that's a basic human structure that humans, we like to do, right? Like, who's like me so I can feel a sense of belonging, let me connect with those people, and let me assume some things so I don't do a lot of work. And just knowing that isn't always the case has been really powerful for me. Again, like, you know, we're not going to get into it. We went through the same coach training program. My biggest breakthrough was opening my heart and being like, you know what? People are amazing whether they like you or not. And I don't know that I fully saw that before. So that has been a really great experience of inclusivity for me. And then I'm a lot happier because I'm less judgmental. And it's not necessarily about DEIB, but just people in general, which then, of course, because they're people, they're like, oh, I don't know, I'm not really sure. That person is acting what I would say is, quote, I'm doing air quotes, quote unquote, strange. But like, is it that maybe that's not strange for them versus like, oh, that's strange because I label it as strange.
Yeah.
Which is a really much more fun way to go through life at the end of the day. That's what it comes down to. It's much more enjoyable.
It's much
more
enjoyable.
Which is what I'm all about.
Expansion. Well, and I think that's actually a piece of what we're all talking about here, you know, from expansion in the world of happiness and fulfillment for everyone. And I love what you said about the piece where, oh, one second, it was great. Well, I guess what I want to pick up is the piece where you said, I get to experience other people and expand my mind and who I am in the world. And what I love about that is what's possible for everyone if there's diversity of thought in the room, including people who don't traditionally get opportunities to do that. And we want to be careful. Then we get into conversations about appropriation, right? And what does that look like?
Yeah.
Right. As we expand into that. But what I think is really interesting about what you said is, you know, when we look at power dynamics in the workplace and people that have been told to normalize to one norm, like, that's what I was going to say. I heard you say, like, it was so easy to think that this was normal, one way of living. And
yeah,
I love all of the beautiful research that's come out in the past 15 years around even neurodiversity and how we've been treating it as a diagnosis or disorders. And what if we were treating it as gifts, and that norm or neurotypical wasn't the centering, right? Like, that wasn't everybody needs to come to the center and meet in neurotypical land, but that we all have differences of thoughts, and that neurodiversity is actually where the gifts are of innovation and creation and creativity. And if it was treated like that, instead of, oh, these people need to learn how to be normal or to meet us in normal, how much would change? And I think it's the same thing with race. You know, the thing I want to say about white supremacy in organizations is that typically the people who have the power that are at the top, traditionally we've seen that be white men or white women at the top. They, when I say that they're losing too, I want to be really clear about what that means. They're losing out on experiences of being in community with people. Because think about it, if you're at the top, chances are you're racing pretty hard to stay at the top. I don't know anybody who's ever been at the top who doesn't work really, really hard to not lose the spot at the top. And that's a normal human response. But what that does is it causes the same thing that we're seeing other people struggle with who aren't at the top. Because you're still burned out. You're still overworked. You're still overproducing. It's still costing you sleep and all the well-being issues that we see in the coaching land. You're just coming from a different side of the coin. So you're doing the same things, but the only difference is yours is to keep the top and other people's are to get to the top or to get to a place of equality. And so if we were having a completely different conversation outside of that, and we really were grounded in what if all means all, and power dynamics weren't used for anything other than acknowledging what's there and then being together and bringing people along, what would we create with ROI?
I want to get into the ROI piece here, because that's kind of the head-based impact. But I think you and I are in agreement based on what we've been talking about. At the end of the day, that is what moves the needle in a business at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And so I think it's acknowledged as important. Before we go into that part, maybe to wrap this up, I want to ask you about blind spots that you see working with leaders around this. Because I know you get you and the C-Suite Collective, you get hired a lot for this sort of work. What are some of the, like, they know they have a problem, or maybe they don't think it's a problem, but somebody's like, hey, we need to do some work around this. But what are the blind spots that of leaders that you've specifically worked with? And what is the impact for them, not just as a leader, but as a person? Like, as the whole person, when they start to acknowledge this, and it might be working with a coach, it might be learning, just but like the impact of all these things, kind of going back to what we talked about, is what are we missing out by not understanding the impact of that? And I'd love to hear some tangible examples from people that you've worked with.
Yeah, well, there's been a couple leaders. I'll start with the ones at the top that maybe weren't bought in, but their company says that they need to, right? Those people are the ones that I do work with in that arena. All the work we do is to slow down and look at what the impact is on them first.
Elaine, I want to ask you, when you say they're not bought in, can we clarify, are they don't believe it's important to the bottom line, or like, what is it they're not bought in with?
It moves the conversation. Yeah. They don't believe it's bought into the bottom line. It's like, look, I haven't met any leaders at the top that overtly like hate humans. I have not come into the contact with that person one time, right? Like, they're, that would be weird. And also,
that'd be a miserable existence for them.
Yeah. And, you know, I think they're holding a lot and there's a lot going on there, but what I find is that when they're like, no, this doesn't have any impact for our company, they're missing some key points, not only for their experience as a leader, how could it go differently instead of how heavy it probably is for them at that moment. And I really mean like with overwhelm, burnout, stress, all of these things that we talk about at the top, being lonely at the top, not having anybody in your circles to mastermind or co-create with. So there's that impact. But from a business standpoint, you know, some of the things we're seeing is that when people don't want to be in a company with a toxic culture, they don't care how much money they're making. They don't care what title they have. Yeah, true. They don't care if they're in the job of their dreams. If they are not valued and seen, they're going to leave and they're going to find another place to be that's in alignment with their values. So the very first measure of ROI that we can look for is if people are in seats that they love and they feel supported and seen and are in alignment with their values, they're probably going to stay and they're going to be some of your legacy people. So when we're recreating culture from an environment where people actually want to stay and build and grow, that's the first piece we talk about is legacy. So what's the legacy that you want to create and how does that directly correlate to your culture? When we talk about people that are seen, felt, heard, their voices are welcomed, their innovation is welcomed, we see increases in sales of products. That's a very specific example that I have, where all of a sudden, somebody who was producing at one level is now producing at five times the level that they were because they are in flow with their ideas and they're not being shut down. So therefore, they have expanded their wings and their own leadership to be able to show up to the table and bring more. And they're more invested, again, from the previous conversation of their values aligned with your company. So now we see people in the right seats, we see people staying longer, and we see people producing more, but I would say more from a place of culture and buy-in. They're bought into the product or whatever piece you're selling in the world because they believe it from a different place. So this isn't just more for capitalism to create more in a white supremacy structure. It is to slow down and actually say, do I agree with this company? Do I agree with what they're doing in the world? Do I want to support it in the world? And then how can I bring my gifts to the table to do that? And these are the companies in the last 5 years that we've seen start to edge forward. These are the companies that in the middle of a pandemic or in the middle of a recession or in the middle of an election year are still doing okay and are not like laying people off.
Yeah.
So when I talk about ROI, I talk about what are the business results you want to see from a holistic, healthy place, as opposed to the old model of systems and business first over people.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts, collecting my thoughts.
Good.
Like that was a lot. That was a lot of powerful stuff there. I think I'm trying to think how I want to wrap this powerfully. I think what I'd like to talk to anybody listening right now who feels this in some way, who feels this. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard this a lot too, but I hear this a lot regarding age.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or age, generally younger, and I'm smart, Ivy League educated many times, like smart, but there's this deference to experience and age. I coach a lot of folks in consulting companies, and this is like a thing. The partner's doing their thing, and it's kind of like command and control structure. And I'm just really present to a conversation I had. They said, I have so many good ideas, but I don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But so age is something we haven't talked about here, but I think it applies in some ways where people feel discriminated against their age, of course, as well.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what it is that people are not feeling like a sense of belonging, what would you say to them in terms of how do you practice it going differently?
Hmm. Well, that's so good. I'm thinking about one of the workshops we ran last week where we literally had everybody just sit down at the table and we created some agreements of what the intention was for the conversation, what the parameters were for the conversation, what we could commit to within the conversation, and then getting some feelings out on the table and moderating some of the breakdowns that were happening in the space.
Okay.
And that's where I would start, you know, like get a mediator to support you with some of those things first. And what emerged was really beautiful conversations around what each side had to bring and where each side felt unheard. Mm-hmm. And from there, a plan was co-created about who they were going to be for each other moving forward. So beautiful. Even just that simple conversation, whether, you know, it can grow over time into business results, but starting there is the getting real place.
Hmm. Isn't it, as you say it, I'm thinking, I'm like, this is so simple. Yeah, it's so not simple.
Yeah.
You're like, exactly. wait, hold on a minute. So I just want to be clear. You had people sit down, you agreed what the conversation is, and then you allowed people to be themselves. And the magic was created.
And we held space, amazing. Right? And you held space. And then they, you know, and when it got gnarly, because it does, we took breath, we did somatic work, we slowed down. But the agreement was to stay in the conversation. And nobody left.
Yeah.
Right? Wow.
And if they needed to leave, we took a time out and we said when we were going to come back. And then we honored that. Right. So there's a lot of ways you can start, but it really can be just very simple from the very beginning to figure out what's actually going on.
Yeah. Now, I think I want to wrap here with talking to the leaders listening, people leaders, people leaders, because it's great to be the person who wants to feel more of a belonging. And a lot of this, in my experience, in my career, is dependent on how your leader shows up or your management chain. So I want to talk to the leaders now. You hear this all the time. I hear this all the time. I want my team to have a sense of belonging. I want them to have their own, have a sense of team identity, individual identity. I want them to be happy here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of companies, that is a big, like where my wife works, that's actually a measurement that she is specifically scored on. Is, do you feel like your manager supports you, trusts you? Do you have a sense of belonging, and can you show up however you want? So for leaders who are going, you know what? I know that there's people on my team who don't feel safe, or don't feel heard, and want to own their impact and do something differently. What would you say to those leaders? And yes, they need to be doing their work too. And to me, if the leader can start to do this and model this, that's how you can make exponential change happen over time. Because that's how you make the cultural shift. So we'll just say, if there's a leader here that says, hey, Elaine, I want to really work with you, or I want you to work with my team and with me on how we can really create this sense of belonging on my team, and all are welcome, diversity of thought, diversity of identity, and all these things, but I'm just not sure how. Of the confines of a company. Where would you go with that?
I would say the first thing is, let's have a conversation about what you're willing to do. So that would be the very first place to start, is as a leader, what are you willing to do to change this? And it is, what are you willing to do and who are you willing to be? So of course we're looking at being in that conversation, but really, like, let's get really real about how far you're willing to go with this conversation to create the vision that you see. And then when we know what that vision looks like and where you want to be, it is starting the hard conversations about what can you own? What have you not seen? What are you scared of? What can you share transparently to model transparency in real time? And what can you own about trust being broken that has people not wanting to show up? That's some of the deeper work to start with. And that's just the start.
And is that generally something that's one-on-one work, because they may need to, that's where you'll help them do their work there so that they can show up with the team in preparation for that.
Typically we start with one-to-one, but if it's a small executive team that wants to do this work together, we can do it in group setting as well. But I think our line in the sand is, if the leaders don't want to do it first, then this conversation won't change anything. So just like you said earlier. Exactly. They have to go first, right? So that's really where we just start.
You're like, otherwise, it's like, let's just all call it out. We're checking a box here. We're doing what we're checking a box. Yeah. One of the things that I like to ask when things like this come up or writing, like, what for? And they're like, because it can help. Well, like, what for? Like, Elena, we really want a blank, blank. You probably have this it's almost a sales conversation. We really want a blank, blank, blank. What for?
Yeah, exactly. And then what will that lead to?
And then they're like, wait, nobody's ever asked me what for. It's just the thing we're supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like, we lower our attrition. Is that really all you care? Is that the only thing you want? And so it's, at the end of the day, I love the work you and the C-Suite Collective are doing around, like, what you just said is helping leaders own their impact. And there's always something that leaders can own. It doesn't mean they will. And by they, I'm speaking to myself as well, leader in many ways in my life. And so for the leaders that are listening, what's a way that they can start the work? If somebody's just thinking right now, because, like, I know how my brain works, I don't know about you, but, like, listen to a podcast, I'm like, ooh, I feel convicted. I feel seen. Oh, there's things I can own. Mm-hmm. Like, I can go talk to Elena tomorrow, but today I'm in the car driving home to see my family. What's like, how do people get present to that? Because you mentioned a couple things.
Yeah.
You mentioned what can we own, but also like, what do I not know?
Yeah. What do you not know? Which is a hard question to ask on your own, right? Because we don't know what we don't know. But you could ask, what have you been sitting on that you're afraid of addressing? Mm. What's been in the space that you know is there, the elephant in the room that you haven't touched, or that you've tried to touch but you've given up on, or you're resigned about? That could be another great coaching question. What are you resigned about right now? What do you think is not going to shift? And then getting really clear on what the choices are around that to move forward towards your vision.
Beautiful. Elena, thank you so much. I'm really glad we were able to come in, get deeper on this conversation. Thank you for being with me as I'm just asking the things that over
thank
here
you.
Is, I may not know. No, that I may not know. I really appreciate you sharing your truth about both your past, what you're doing now, and the idea that, like, one thing I think we do have in common is we have a commitment to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that this is inspiring for everybody listening and that you all go out and do something to make a change in your life or your organization if you're a leader, or if you're like being willing, like you said, being willing to do the work yourself so that you can show up in that room no matter how you identify and go, I belong here. Because that, and I will leave with this, that's the feeling I've had my whole life.
Yeah.
White guy in sales. I'm like, you know what? I'm selling other white people in sales. This is fine. I belong. I've never walked in a room and like, that person's dangerous. That person's dangerous. And so this is the feeling I've had. And I want everybody to have that feeling because I didn't choose this, just like nobody else chose how they were born. And this is just the reality. So I think it's important. And the diversity of thought and action and different perspectives will make such a difference for this world.
Me
such
too.
A difference for this world, which is what matters the most. So thank you, Elena.
That's what I believe. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Talking to Cool People with Jason Frizzell. If you enjoyed today's episode, please tell your friends. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook and give us a shout out, or take a moment to leave a review on iTunes. If something from today's episode piqued your interest and you'd like to connect, email us at podcast@jasonfrizzell.com. We love hearing from our listeners because you're cool people too.